And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today we're going to talk with Robin Philpott in Montreal. He's a publisher, and he's also an authority, I believe, on African literature. And we have lost a great writer in Chinua Achebe. And there's been many long and really impressive essays being written about the loss of this great writer. And we're going to ask Robin about that. Particularly, we're going to focus on the subject of Mr. Achebe's objection to a member of the, what they call it, the canon of Western literature, Joseph Conrad, who wrote The Heart of Darkness. And Achebe is one of those who points out that perhaps Brussels and London and Paris and New York are the heart of darkness, and that they need to, we all need to examine who Joseph Conrad was and what he thought he was saying. The rise of Mr. Achebe is very important in correcting the false view of Africa. It was sort of, it's an interesting cultural question. Every country that's ever experienced colonialism has this issue of having other cultures and writers foisted on them and being told that they are inferior to that high standard. So we'll be doing that, and that'll be coming up shortly. And then also we're going to be talking with Aimab Mogara and, about the latest development in Rwanda, a rather strange twist. A commander of forces in eastern Congo suddenly appeared in the neighboring country of Rwanda and was taken into the U.S. Embassy, where he made himself a willful prisoner. He wanted to be taken out of that region. We don't know whether he was trying to get out of eastern Congo or he was trying to get out of Rwanda, but the United States and Rwanda collaborated to remove Bosco Ntaganda. And so we're going to talk to Aimab Mogara of RwandaHumanRights.com, who's an excellent writer, and he certainly follows all these things very closely. We have some text here, too. The Friends of the Congo are commenting on this. And it's a very interesting story. Phil Conlon is here with me. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Now, listen, we have to make sure we announce some things because we've just been mentioned that David Barsamian is going to be here at Hart House Debates Room, 12 noon on March the 27th, Wednesday, and it's tickets are $30, and the proceeds are going to go to the CIUT upcoming membership drive, The Evolution Continues. That's a very important date. Mr. Barsamian, who is often their interlocutor with Noam Chomsky, is going to be talking about the latest book the two of them have produced, and of course, a number of other matters, but it's a great opportunity, and I want to make sure people remember. And Phil, you have some announcements, too.
Yes, we have several, and we'll just start with this one. In Hamilton, on Friday and Saturday, we have events around Palestinian Land Day. On Friday, the Palestinian Center of Hamilton, 798 Concession Street at East 32nd. The speakers will be Abu Al-Hamdi, diplomatic counselor of the Palestinian General Delegation, Jamal El-Zahaga, member of the Knesset from Israel, and please call 905-906-3930. And then on Saturday, also in Hamilton at 1 p.m., Saturday, March 30th, rally to support Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike, and that'll be at Effort Square, 105 Main Street East at Catherine Street South in Hamilton.
Terrific. And by the way, you're doing something rather exciting tomorrow, aren't you?
Yes,
At
12 o'clock. For the first time at Classical Underground, we are bringing some live musicians. These are young professionals, some of them still students, some of them who finished their studies to play chamber music on the radio. We can't find the last time that live classical music was produced specifically for a radio audience in Canada, but we think it's a generation or two. We're very excited. It'll be tomorrow at noon.
I hope people are not surprised that it's produced by CIUT and at the University of Toronto. It's a this is, if such a thing is going to happen, this is the place for it to take place. Other matters that we want to make sure we talk about, there's a story, people, will, our listeners will remember, in Libya, NATO, under Obama and Sarkozy and Hillary Clinton, bombed and bombed and bombed and assisted and assisted and assisted, and eventually led to the collapse of the government of Libya and the murder of its leader, shown to the whole world, like trophy killing in the old days of the Romans. And when, if you remember those, that, that matter, you will remember that there was a man, Bernard-Henri Lévy, whose hair always seems to be blowing in the wind, and it's just cut to the right length, and he's got an open shirt, and he's known as a philosopher, and he also is known for having $1 billion personally. So he's a friend of the people, you know. And he had to be on the scene because he'd been one of the great advocates of the crushing of Libya. And he was full of all kinds of authoritative statements about what a wonderful democracy is going to be built and all kinds of things were going to happen. Well, one of the things has happened now. According to the Jewish Daily Forward in New York, Sarkozy has been invited, this is just in the past few days, has been invited to Tripoli. And he, of course, in his entourage, was going to bring along his handsome friend, the learned, great, you know, figure, Bernard-Henri Lévy. However, the prime minister of Libya said, please don't do that. And Jewish Daily Forward and its correspondents investigated what had happened, because they did not take Bernard-Henri with them. And it turned out that the Islamist elements, it didn't want a Jewish figure of any note to visit them in Tripoli. So this is the wonderful progress, and it's the man himself. They don't want him based on race or whatever. I don't know how he would put it. But it's a little moment of bigotry, and he's the guy who's... photo is on the front of it. So if he's giving us a lot of advice about what we should do in Syria. We're very similar to his advice on Libya. Incidentally, he is a cynical blankety blank, because he also agreed not to go. And he told, according to the Jewish Daily Forward, he told Sarkozy thought, well, I shouldn't go either. And Bernard-Henri said, no, it's very important. You must go, you know, because we have friends there, and we don't want them to be in more jeopardized than they already are. So Sarkozy agrees that Mr. Lévy can't be there based on anti-Semitism. That's okay. That's amazing. As I really thank the new, I think it used to be a daily. I think you can get, go to its website. And
I think it's just called The Forward now.
It's called The Forward, but when I went to their website, it's Jewish Daily Forward.
Well, okay, then that's their historical name. It was a daily newspaper.
That's because it's now on the net.
Yeah.
I think the print edition is probably not every day. But at any rate, that's a sign of this was one of the authoritative figures. If you look at the photos of Sarkozy's first visit, when the dust was just rising and the blood was still flowing in the streets, Bernard-Henri Lévy was smiling and looking like a champion. Of course, into the sunset, he was squinting. That's how it's all done. You never make sure. Everybody points a camera at you, squint into the sun. And, of course, your hair is going to be okay, because he takes a guy, fixes it with him wherever he goes. Another matter I want to make sure I touch on is that there's a pogroms taking place in Myanmar, recently visited by the President of the United States, the Secretary of State of the United States, everybody. There's a big let's all make nice with each other. So, and the Toronto Star describes the new government as partially democratic, and it's replaced the bad guys. Well, under the bad guys, there were not pogroms against Muslims, but they're going on now. And a wonderful website called The Angry Arab says, where are all the jihadists? I thought they always ran to save their fellow Muslims. He said, no, no. He said they don't have their oil and gas contracts. Unless they have their oil and gas contracts, they don't go to help anybody. And this is ugly stuff. And by the way, typical of Western media, they treat it as though the Muslims are somehow partially responsible. These are people who aren't even granted citizenship. And not just for now, this is for like a century or so. And they pose it as, oh, on the one hand, oh, and then on the other hand, when in fact the whole neighborhoods are being burned down and people are being assaulted in the street. But because we now have a new love relationship going between the Washington group and this London's educated woman who is the epitome of democracy, she's the Mandela of Myanmar, etc., she can't be found to open her mouth, not a word, on behalf of the Muslims of Myanmar who are victims, as I'm talking, of a pogrom. And which brings me to a thought from Ambrose Bierce, a Civil War veteran who wrote The Devil's Dictionary. And he said, we have to redo the dictionary and get words clear. Now, for example, and the word defenseless means unable to attack. And that would apply to this Nobel Prize winning woman. She was the victim, and everybody felt sorry for her. Now she's one of the power group, certainly one who is inviting President Obama. But she is comfortable with the Muslims being assaulted. So this is not a pretty picture. But like with Mr. Bernard Henri Lévy, now we see who they are. And neither one of them are very pretty to look at. I think we're joined by Robin Philpott of Baraka Books. Are you there, Robin?
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
Very well. And hey, thank you very much. We have lost a great author. Now, I should tell our listeners, you, of course, traveled in Africa, and that's one of the reasons our thoughts turned to you.
Mm-hmm.
You've also written about Chinua Achebe.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chinua Achebe, I mean, I read him when I was living in Toronto in the late 60s because it was somebody who sort of introduced me to Africa. He was known as the father of the modern African novel. And, you know, he was born in 1930s, and his major novel, people know it, sold 10 million. Copies of it, is Things Fall Apart, and it undoes a bit of a European view of colonialism and presents an African standpoint in that novel. But so he was a very important man.
I ask you what we're on that point about? You first read him here.
Yeah, because I'd heard him on.
Had you been to Africa yet, or were you preparing, or was that one of the things that caused you to go?
That was one of the things that sort of was working my said I want to go there, and I that was when I read his novel and heard about him, and that was like in the late 60s, and then I went in the early 70s, he was a very great author and a great African writer, and I mean. You know, one of the things that struck me the most, and why, I mean, I read his novels, and I recommend them highly, but once again, his essays are not something to be neglected.
Mm-hmm.
He's written some, I can give you the names of them. One of them is Hopes and Impediments, Selected mm-hmm. Essays, and it was published in 1989, mm-hmm. and another one called Home and Exile. And they're full
at Home and Exile.
Home and Exile, published in 2000.
Home and Exile, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then in 2009, he published another book of essays called The Education of a British Protected Child, because he was under the British protection. And, you know, they're wonderful stories of visions of how Africans see the world and saw the world that they were was imposed upon them.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the biggest points, and we've talked about it before, you and I, but it's the way he how he dealt with Conrad. He was one of the he's an intellectual. I would say he's of the in the leagues of Edward Said, in a sense, of taking apart racism and prejudice in the Western world. And he wrote a number of essays, and it became a real obsession for him was to take apart Joseph Conrad.
Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Conrad's book, that's must reading in all undergraduate literature courses.
Yes, I've taken a number of courses in different institutions in Conrad. You go to a used bookstore and you'll see.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it's still, as far as I understand, it still is. And The Heart of Darkness is the flagship book for Conrad. And Chinua Achebe doesn't mince his words about it. He says, and if you want me to, I'll quote it. He says, The Heart of Darkness is a thoroughly racist book which parades in the most vulgar fashion the prejudices and insults from which a section of mankind has suffered untold agonies and atrocities in the past and continues to do so in many ways and in many places today. He was extremely furious. And he said, the main problem is how Conrad dehumanizes Africa and Africans. And he has this quote, which, you know, of course, if anybody goes through the Heart of Darkness, it comes out very clearly, and where he calls into question the humanity of Africans.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this book is still presented as a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's a canon, part of the canon, kind of a 19th century canon.
Yeah, exactly.
Aimed at Africa.
Well, the interesting thing is that it was a 19th century canon. In fact, it was 1902, and Conrad says, of course, the problem is no. Achebe says the problem is not just Conrad's. He says, it was and is the dominant image of Africa in the Western imagination.
Absolutely. But by the way, my understanding is that he also pointed out when people said, or they did the old trick of, he was just a man of his time. He said, well, but there were other European writers of his time, and they didn't write like that.
Well, of course. That's an important point. Yeah. And there were other travelers to Haiti, to around the world, who didn't have the reaction. And some people said, we can debate about the Heart of Darkness. But Achebe said, Conrad, and if you please excuse the expression, he says, and I'm citing Achebe, he said, Conrad had a problem with niggers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he quoted in one of his books, one of Conrad's books, he said, a certain enormous buck,
mm-hmm.
I will not say the word,
yeah.
encountered in Haiti, fixed my, Conrad, my conception of blind, furious, unreasoned rage as manifested in the human animal to the end of my days. Of the N, I used to dream for years afterwards. That is Conrad writing about his experience.
By the way, is that a memoir? Where does that appear?
That appears in one of, I have the title, I had it in front of me shortly, I can't tell you the title, but mm-hmm. it's... If you go to the New York Times article on Saturday, they bring this in, and then he says the New York Times article, and you click on the images of Accra. It's taken from the book Chinua Achebe, Hopes and Impediments, and the reference to the origins there. But even if you click from the New York Times, you'll come upon that expression, that what I've just read.
Yeah.
So it is. And unfortunately, people, generally speaking, are either they don't want to know that Achebe took these very clear positions and want to make it a case. There were some people who tried to have it removed from curricula in the North American colleges, but then.
Well, that wouldn't be the answer. The answer would be say no, teach it, go right ahead, show what it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
Everybody should grow up and say, you see what we have here?
Right.
And then lay it alongside Mr. Achebe's writing,
right.
which exposes it. And I think they would rather put it on a shelf than have reveal who exposed this.
Right.
In other words, you move forward with Mr. Achebe.
Right.
But you know, there's a Fanon moment in this, I noticed. I was looking at the New York Times obituary, and there's a long appreciation piece, too. They have two mm-hmm. articles on it. And he said that he went through a phase where he thought, okay, this is literature. Whatever an Englishman writes, that's literature.
Yeah.
And then, and he tried to master it. Mm-hmm. And then he says, he agreed with it. In other words, he sort of swallowed it. Then they quote him, "These writers had pulled a fast one on me. I was not on Marlowe's boat steaming up the Congo in the heart of darkness. Rather, I was one of those unattractive beings jumping up and down on the riverbank, making horrid faces."
That's it.
And that's a Fanon moment, right, where you say, right. Whoa, wait a minute.
No, that is good. That is really good. And the man greatly influenced letters in everywhere, I would say. And, you know, we got invited through Ishmael Reed to a salon, the Harlem Art Salon, where Ishmael Reed was discussing or debating with Toni Morrison, who is a Nobel Prize for Literature in the United States. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions asked of Toni Morrison, and we were privileged to be at that event, one of the questions asked, well, what are the influences on your writing? And she said, well, in the 1960s, I was reading Achebe, Chinua Achebe. Mm-hmm. And there was a man there who, I think it was Things Fall Apart, she said, and, you know, he didn't want his wife to leave, and so he ran his hand through her hair, and her hair was tight, curly hair, and it was just really nice, really beautiful. And she said, never before in anything that I ever read was an African woman's hair called beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the 60s.
Never
know.
Before.
Yeah, and she said she never read that before, and she said, it was so important for her writing. This is of course before the Afro existed, and mm-hmm. of course hair for many people is still a problem, apparently. And but anyway, she said that
issue.
Came from Achebe.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. So a great writer, and I really do think his stuff on Conrad, people should read that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an eye opener when I read his essays on that. You know.
Yeah, by the way, he had similar comments about the Anglo-Irishman Joyce Carey for a book called Mr. Johnson.
Yeah.
And again, you know, we need to be a kind of, have this wake up, as they called it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
We just calmly read things and think, well, okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it doesn't register what it is we're actually seeing, and
right.
and then you get this resistance of denial stuff, where he, you know, people were appreciating Mr. Achebe, but when he said "Heart of Darkness" and Joseph Conrad, suddenly the hackles went up.
Right.
But then that was a test of him, because he didn't retreat. He didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I offended one of your great writers."
In fact, he came back in 2009 in his book, latest book of essays, the last one, I think. He had more on it. In other words, he just kept going on it. And some people just sort of treated him politely as a great writer, but we're not going to talk about that aspect of his writing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is essential to it. There's mm-hmm. another anecdote which shows how he helped, I would say, upset the apple cart. Apparently, he ran into James Baldwin mm-hmm. in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he said to James Baldwin, he said, "Mr. Baldwin, I presume."
Yeah.
People will know the reference.
Yeah. Livingston, yes.
Yeah, Livingston,
Dr. Livingston.
Family. Meeting in the jungle.
Yeah.
So here he ran into Baldwin.
Yeah, in the darkest jungles. That was Florida?
Yeah.
You're not kidding.
Anyway.
He probably should have tried to rescue him.
Right. And you have on your website my book on Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
and I've used in parts of Achebe as a template to study what people were saying about Rwanda. And it was extremely helpful, because you can see that the images and the metaphors and everything used when discussing Rwanda are just straight out of Conrad. You know, I mean, and that's why writers like, they take the time to also write nonfiction or write essays like Achebe, they really are a help. They help us a lot, you know.
Yeah. No, they. It was the Rwanda experience. Definitely, we were not allowed to analyze it. They weren't told we were treating human beings. Instead, these were maddened savages out of our old movies, the Tarzan movies, and everything else.
Right.
And so it's sort of like we were supposed to say to one another, "Well, what did you expect?" Or isn't that how they are? Instead of seeing it as a political phenomenon, very much involving a bunch of white powerful states, by the way, which Mr. Achebe would be among the first to point out. I'm really glad we're able to talk about him. We should treat him more and more. By the way, just mention that title one more time, where they can find the essay, if you would.
The essay Conrad. On Conrad is in Hopes and Impediments, Selected Essays. Mm-hmm. And it's an image of Africa, racism, and the article in that book is called An Image of Africa, Racism in Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And there he goes from A to Z, you know, on the question. There you'll have the quote about his first experience of meeting a black man, which was in Haiti, and where he made those terrible statements. Mm-hmm. You know, this was, and he wrote it down, you know.
Well,
of course.
I hate to say it. He's not the only one.
Sure.
That was a fairly. The problem was it was rather common to do it. But the other issue is, why don't we celebrate those guys who objected to it? And there were several.
Yeah.
But they certainly had their problems for fighting for the fact that you're dealing with human beings in a different culture, and there was supposed to be a modicum of respect, and they.
Right.
And they had, and to do that, you had to be resisting in European culture,
right? And
because otherwise, you lose the role of the patron, the tutelage role. The Americans, for example, are tutors to the world now.
Right. Exactly. I published a book by the great Quebec navigator Bernier, who discovered the Arctic and everything, and he was traveling the same time as Conrad. He was traveling around the world, and he went to Haiti, and he wrote, but kept his notes. Well, of course, he described his first meeting of an African in Haiti.
Yes.
Didn't say anything like that. Didn't write like Conrad.
Yeah. You know, somebody.
In other words, so you just see that he was a racist.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, other people might have run into an African the first time. And they run into somebody, you know. Yeah. They don't have that kind of vision, you know.
Another person who met Haitians and was very appreciative was Simon Bolivar.
There you go.
Who said, "Hey, these are my friends, and they're going to help me liberate my country."
Right.
Robin Philpott, Baraka Books, I really appreciate those comments. We look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Robin Philpott at Baraka Books, and we're going to be... take a short break. This is CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And we will be speaking to Imam Mugara in just a few moments. And we're back to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, we have a website, Taylor-Report.com, where our previous programs are available, and today's will be shortly. And we are joined, I believe, by Imam Mugara of Rwanda Human Rights. Is it Human Rights? RwandaHumanRights.com. Are you there, Imam?
Hey, hi, Phil. Yes, I'm here.
Hey, it's very good to talk to you, as it's very timely. We have a couple of major stories coming from centered on Rwanda. One is, of course, the fate of Victoire Ingabire, who I understand there's an appeal of her sentence to, I believe, 8 years. But the matter that probably we should start with is referring to the International Criminal Court, where Bosco Ntaganda has strangely left East Congo, where he was a commander, and has appeared suddenly at the U.S. Embassy, and they accepted him into the building. And he asked to be sent to the International Criminal Court. So let's start. Who is Bosco Ntaganda?
So Bosco Ntaganda, he's actually known as the Terminator in Eastern Congo. Mm-hmm. And the reason why he's known as the Terminator in Eastern Congo is because him and his forces are accused of serious crimes. They are accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity. They're accused of using child soldiers. They're accused of raping thousands of women. Mm-hmm. They're accused of killing hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Mm-hmm. And he's actually nicknamed the Terminator because the Congolese civilians.
Hello?
Because the Congolese civilians.
Can you hear me, Imam? Hello? We may have to get him back, I think.
Sorry.
Oh, there he is.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. sorry about that. So you were saying he's called the Terminator, and you gave all the awful evidence of why he would have such a name. Is he the leader of this phenomenon? What's it called, the M23?
Yes, he was the leader of the M23 movement until recently.
There's a problem there. I think it might be an incoming call. That would be my guess. We're waiting to get him back. He may be with us. We're having trouble with.
I think I should be back now. Sorry.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Perhaps it's incoming calls. Would you know? We can't. It seems to break. But.
Yeah, there seems to be an incoming call, so now I have stopped it.
Good. Okay.
So hopefully it won't come
maybe
back.
I could ask you, because it's kind of, is the country of Congo was invaded twice, once in 1996, as I recall, and the other was, I think, 1998. Was he involved in that?
Absolutely. So he was involved in both invasions. And before that, in 1990, he was involved in the invasion of Rwanda from Uganda.
From the beginning, the first RPF invasion from Uganda.
Absolutely. He had to rejoin that invasion. He was at the young age of 17. Mm-hmm. But he just grew within the RPF ranks and proved himself as a ruthless warlord. Mm-hmm. And so when it was time to go into Congo, he joined the rebellion in Congo. Mm-hmm. The idea being that he had lived there for a few years, but he was actually born in Rwanda in 1973.
He born in Rwanda. And this, of course, is an issue of some importance because the government of Rwanda does not recognize the International Criminal Court, and the government of the United States does not recognize the International Criminal Court, that is to say, they don't intend to cooperate. However, both of them did, and my understanding is that they're trying to identify him as Congolese because the Congo does recognize the International Criminal Court. Am I right?
That's right. Congo does recognize the International Criminal Court.
So he gets to be a Congolese for this purpose.
Yeah, for the purpose of this, the U.S. and Rwanda may talk about him as a Congolese, but even the International Criminal Court itself, in its indictment, they do identify him as Rwandan.
Uh-huh. There seems to be one aspect of this seems to be that they have been sort of trying out leaders, and he was a leader for a while, but there's a claim that actually he's been succeeded and therefore is a problem to other potential leaders of this, what's it called, the March 23rd, M23 or something?
Right, with the M23 movement.
Movement, I'm sorry, M23, yes.
Yes, so from the moment that movement started, there seems to be this international opinion against more bloodshed in Congo. Because there's been wars on and off for the past 17 years in Congo. Mm-hmm. There's been more than 5 million civilians killed during that time. It's basically the worst civilian carnage since World War II. and some people in the international community have just said, you know, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. And so when this M23 started again rebelling and mm-hmm. along the way causing deaths of civilians and the rapes that come with the wars in the Congo, there seemed to be this renewed opposition to such rebellion nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So from then on, it did not help that movement was being led by a war criminal who has been indicted by the ICC.
Yeah.
So he has two international arrest warrants against him.
Mm-hmm.
So with time, in their attempt to kind of clean up their image, the M23 seem to have chosen a new leader.
Yeah.
And then so somewhere along the way, it looks like there was no more place left for the Terminator Bosco Ntaganda.
Yeah. And so he thought maybe the best place for himself would be a clean, well-lighted place in Holland, as opposed to a damp spot in East Congo. We're speaking to Imam Mugara, and he has a very good website, Rwanda Human Rights. You find essays there which will provide a very good background to this subject. I noticed something, Imam, that I'm very curious about. There's a statement out today from the Friends of the Congo, and they raised a name that actually I was much more acquainted with because I followed this gentleman more closely. His name was Laurent Nkunda. He was the previous bad guy, right? This is because Mr. Ntaganda is bad guy number two, but bad guy number one was Laurent Nkunda, and he's living in Rwanda, is he not?
You're right. The Nkunda guy, he before the Terminator, there was Nkunda. He's also wanted. He has committed. He's accused of committed so many war crimes and crimes against humanity. But then, just before the Terminator was chosen as a new Kagame's man in Congo, Nkunda was put aside. So Rwanda claims that he's under house arrest. They claim that he's been under house arrest for the last four or 5 years or so.
Apparently, but a fairly nice house.
From what I hear, he's in a nice house. Plus, from what I hear, he actually walks around freely in the capital city of Rwanda, in Kigali.
Yeah. Well, I think that we should say yes. Mr. Kagame's idea of house arrest is the living downtown Kigali with him.
Yeah, apparently, it looks like.
You know, I have to put to you a rather, I think in the back of all of our minds is a simple observation which we ought to put in the front, which is there's some suggestion that Mr. Bosco Ntaganda is what they call in the movies a fall guy. You know, the one who says, okay, I'll go to prison for the gang, for the mob. I'll do that for the mob.
Yeah, you're right. There's many theories as to why this guy who's been running, like the first arrest warrant was 2006, the second one was in 2012, and then the entire time since 2006, he's been running and running and running. I mean, when I say running, I mean if he really wanted to cooperate, he would have cooperated in 2006 or 2007 or 2008, but mm-hmm. instead, he had his army protecting him. I hear he used to play tennis with some of the UN peacekeepers in Congo, but they couldn't do anything to him because he had all these men who are ready to fight for him. And so yes. for him to suddenly say, okay, I'm here at the U.S. embassy, I'm here to turn myself in,
mm-hmm.
it raises eyebrows as to what would motivate that.
Yeah, and going forward, again, the Friends of the Congo are discussing this, and actually I think it's a problematic situation because they are now talking once again of a international oversight to peacekeeping in the Eastern Congo. Shouldn't they be talking about the sovereignty of the Congo? And with the idea that, no, it doesn't really require elements of neighboring armies to wear blue helmets. Shouldn't the question be all these elements that have come over from Rwanda and Uganda have to go home?
Absolutely. I think part of this, the regional blue helmets, the African forces that are supposed to go into that region, I think part of it is for them to really make sure that Rwandan forces are not crossing into Congo, that Rwandan and Ugandan forces are mm-hmm. staying on their side of the border. Mm-hmm. It seems that so far the Congolese army itself has not been up to the task. They are good at complaining that, yes. here are the Rwandan forces, oh, here are the Ugandan mm-hmm. forces, but they can't really stand a chance against them. So the idea is that having like the South African blue helmets and the Tanzanians, that they may have more equipment and more training to really stand up to these Rwandan and Ugandan forces that keep violating Congolese sovereignty. Yes.
A presence, by the way, we shall not say, I think, say candidly, a bunch of dubious states who all had a hand in it creating Mr. Kabila. I think we might be suspicious of all their motives. I can remember when the New Yorker writer Philip Gurevich was telling us that the winds of democracy and freedom were blowing towards the Congo out of Rwanda and Uganda. And since he wrote that, I think about 5 million people are dead. And the people blowing those winds in Washington and Dar es Salaam and elsewhere are still there.
You're right. It was a very bad joke, very sad joke indeed, when they were talking about the wind of democracy blowing into Congo from Rwanda. So definitely this idea of the regional peacekeeping force should be taken with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that maybe you never know. Maybe things may be different this time around.
Yeah. Well, we can hope for that. And before I let you go, I better find out, what is the situation of Victoire Ingabire with this appeal? Do you think she has a prospect of a reduction of sentence or perhaps being freed?
So my opinion about that is, for her being freed, next to impossible. A reduction of sentence, I don't know, you never know with all these surprises coming out of Rwanda, such as this Terminator guy who handed himself over to the ICC. Mm-hmm. You never know, there may be a reduction of sentence. But basically what happened today in the Rwandan Supreme Court was that Victoire Ingabire's defense team is appealing her 8-year conviction on the politically charged court case that had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, the prosecution is appealing, asking for a higher sentence.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so,
mm-hmm.
Today, in the court itself, the proceedings were very quick. They basically postponed it to April 16. But in the meantime, something that happened was when you had Victoire Ingabire's supporters who tried to go to court to be there for her. The surroundings of the Supreme Court, like all the roads leading to the Supreme Court, were manned by Rwandan policemen. And those policemen, they assaulted and arrested any of the Victoire's supporters that they could see. So there's a few of them that managed to sneak in and get into the court, but there's a lot of them that were harassed by the police. In fact, the Secretary General of Victoire's political party, mm-hmm. Mr. Sylvain Sibomana, mm-hmm. When he was arrested by the police today, he was beaten so badly that right now he's believed to be in critical condition because of all the beatings he took from the police today on his way.
Beatings
to the court.
Today?
Yes, he was beaten today by the police. It was not just he's among the more prominent people that we've heard about, but mm-hmm. in addition to him, there's many other supporters of Victoire who, as they were peacefully either driving or walking to the Supreme Court, the police attacked them and beat them, and some of them ran away, some of them were arrested.
Now that, I'm really glad that we're getting this report, because I can guarantee you it is not going to be reported in any of our papers. I'm predicting the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, New York Times are not going to report these beatings. which is why we're, you know, people go on saying, well, Bill Clinton is very close to President Kagame and helping him with democracy, as Mr. Wolfowitz and Andrew Young and others who seem to have an unexplained fondness for the president of Rwanda. What do you suppose they get in return for their being such good friends?
You know, that's a question that I keep asking myself too. And I think some of them, like Bill Clinton, I think part of it may be just that originally he had a plan, a plan that involved having American companies work in the Congo and get really cheap deals in exploiting Congolese minerals, mm-hmm. and that Kagame was instrumental in making that plan happen, and so he needs to stand by his side. Yeah. Others, like Tony Blair, I don't know, because I know that he shuttles around the world every now and then on Kagame's private jets.
Wow.
So I don't know if that's something that makes him feel like he's still prime minister years after he's left office.
Yes.
But yeah, it's definitely it's not easily understood as to why these people close their eyes to the crimes committed by Kagame, yeah. and believe that they can actually turn him into a good guy when he's pretty much beyond belief.
Yeah. Well, I think your answer goes a long way toward explaining it. Imam Mugara, you've got a great website, Rwanda Human Rights, and we're really grateful for all the information. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Phil.
Okay, doke. Bye-bye.
Okay,
Imam Mugara, I don't know why I always hesitate, Imam Mugara, and he does have a terrific site, and of course he's a very close observer, as you could tell, of events. We learned today, this is CIUT 89.5, you're learning today that people who wanted to attend the appeal hearing for Victoire Ingabire, former presidential candidate, she was arrested and has her head shaved and wears a pink costume now, thanks to Paul Kagame. That those who only wanted to attend were, one of them was beaten so bad he's hospitalized in very poor condition. Shows the value of alternative radio, I think, among other things. Phil, you had something there.
Yes, we have a couple of announcements. I've got to say, just in connection with the interview, that this image of Tony Blair flying around in a private jet owned by the president of Rwanda is one that's going to really stick in my mind. That's quite an image.
I'd like to have more pictures of the two of them together, personally.
Yes, go on. Okay, so two very important events coming up. On Monday, April 1st, that's a week from tonight, at 7 p.m. at Bet Zitoun, 612 Markham Street, the State of Democracy in Israel. And the speaker will be Dr. Zahalka, who is the head of the very small Palestinian-Israeli contingent in the Israeli parliament. There's three seats in the Knesset that are held by Palestinian Israelis. This, of course, makes Israel a democracy because the, you know, indigenous mm-hmm. populations allowed three seats. So he's the head of that parliamentary coalition, Dr. Jamal Zahalka. He'll speak next Monday, April 1st, 7 p.m. at Bet Zitoun. $5 mm-hmm. is a suggested admission. And on April the 12th is the 175th anniversary of the hanging of Samuel Lount and Peter Matthews by the British authorities here for their part, whatever it was, in the Upper Canada Rebellion of 1837. And
something that in English Canada is treated as though it's something shameful. In French Canada, it's called Patriots Day.
Well, there you go. So, and they will
don't
be.
Don't tell anybody.
There will be two events that day. There'll be a brief commemoration in the morning at 7:45 a.m. at the corner of Court and Toronto Streets, which is where the hanging took place 175 years ago on that date. And that evening on Friday, April the 12th, there'll be the Lount and Matthews Commemoration Salon at the Gladstone Gallery, 1214 Queen Street West, from 7 to 11 p.m. So that is a very important date in Toronto history. I want to say that last year we were very pleased that Charles Roach, notwithstanding his very serious illness, attended that rally. And when I'm attending it this year, I'll be thinking of Charles. He was very interested in this issue.
Let me propose something on air. Please carry a photograph of Charles to the demonstration this year.
That's a great idea. I think that's Charles. A wonderful way to commemorate Lount and Matthews.
Absolutely.
Who, like Charles, wanted to be citizens of a country that didn't involve dissolve the British monarch.
Yes. A terrible capital crime. Thanks, Phil, very much. Just referring back to our interview just moments ago with Imab Mughara, I didn't throw in a quote there that I want to make sure everybody hears. That Susan Rice, who is President Obama's representative in the United Nations, commented on this situation of the Eastern Congo, which, by the way, the world agrees is a mess, and that they also agree that Rwanda is involved. So her term for the problem there in reference to Rwanda is to say they're negatively involved. I mean, that's cutting, isn't it? Negatively. Yeah, I guess, you know, killing citizens of another country so that you can take their minerals and ship them through Rwanda and enrich yourself, that's negative involvement. I would definitely agree with that characterization. You're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. We have a website, Taylor-Report.com. We also want to make sure that our listeners know that Canada lost out again to the U.S. in a major competition to provide a leader for the Syrian Democratic Forces. It turns out that an engineer from London, Ontario, finished a distant second to an engineer from Dallas, Texas, who had better credentials. By the way, half of the people in the meeting practically walked out. A bunch of them quit. But nonetheless, the Gulf states, which are all monarchies, are going to recognize them and invite them to their next meeting. And John Kerry visited Iraq yesterday, a surprise visit. They always call it a surprise visit. I think the reason they make it a surprise is that you might not survive a trip like that otherwise. But he said that Iraq must not permit Iran to ship supplies to the sovereign state of Syria, which is being assaulted on all sides. That would be a bad thing if they did that. And as he was sitting down to meet and to say that to the prime minister of Iraq, a plane load of weapons was arriving from Qatar in Turkey to be delivered to terrorists who are crossing the Syrian border to practice terror. So there's no problem with that. But meanwhile, Kerry says it would be a bad thing. Incident, I would refer you to a website. I was just reading, is it Jeff Greenwald? I always forget.
Glenn, I think.
Glenn Greenwald, yeah. A wonderful writer. Yeah. He said something nice today, but one ought to go to the website of called The Angry Arab. The Angry Arab is documenting all these things, and the beauty of it is he has a political point of view that you couldn't possibly pin down, and you'll never agree with him 100% of the time. Who cares? But it's full of information, such as an arms shipment has arrived from Croatia, and it landed in Jordan. It's an arms shipment from Croatia to Jordan. So the president of the airline said, "Oh, I know nothing about it." So then air traffic controller said, "Well, here's the flight plan, here's the date, here's the plane." And then they said, and by the way, it's on your website. You said you didn't have a plane of that description. It's on your website. So he said, oh, and then he took the website down. So we're dealing with, you know, a bunch of monarchists who are playing at terror, and we're all supposed to, smile and accept it, which is crazy. So that's why you're not so crazy. You're listening to the Taylor Report. And I think that just about does it. We will I want to remind you again that David Barsamian is going to be at Hard House Wednesday at 12 o'clock and $30. And it's he's a very important journalist in producing a new book together with Noam Chomsky. We really look forward to that. That's on the 27th. You've been listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Thanks, Phil, and thanks, Terry. And we'll see you next week.